Okay, good morning. This is the fifth of our series. My first time here, so we're doing the journey of the soul. And I think from what I hear last night, because I did it last night, mine's much more serious than the other ones were. So we're going to go a little academic and a little deep, because that's what I wanted to share, and they gave me a choice. So I want to start with just a little Pesach thought, because it's an important thing to understand, especially when embarking on a journey of understanding some of this stuff. So we have this cup in the middle of the Seder table, the Kos Eliyahu, Elijah's cup. Right, does anybody know why we have it?
Because we want the Mashiach to come, and so when he should come through our door, he can drink from the cup.
Okay.
That's our kids' version.
Right. Definitely there's a thought that Eliyahu comes and drinks from it. Like, why do we have this Eliyahu's cup? And there's movies about it, there's songs about it. Like, what's the story with this cup? So really, what's the story with the other cups? And so we drink four cups. The four cups of wine that we drink are all about four different languages of redemption things that we have in a verse. And it talks about the different ways that we'll be redeemed. We'll be taken out, we'll be redeemed. Hashem will take us to himself as a nation. So there's really four languages, and each one of those words is one of those cups. But there's really actually five words. The fifth word is, and I'll bring you into the land. So the four words happened already, and the fifth word, I'll bring you into the land, is not referring to the first time we went into the land after the exodus from Egypt, but in fact, the next time we're going to go into the land, really, hopefully what's happening right now, but we're not fully there yet, but the final redemption. So it didn't happen yet. So the question is, halachically, should we drink five cups or four cups? So this is one of the very few instances where we don't know what to do. So we made a compromise. We pour the fifth cup, but we don't drink it. And we don't really know what the halacha is. So, but there is somebody who does know, and the person who does know is Eliyahu. And when he comes, he's going to solve all the questions that we have like that. So really, what's in the center of the Seder table is a question mark. We don't know. And I think it's a fascinating to think about that in this time of our passing on, of the transmission of all the information from the previous generations into the next generation, which is what the Seder night's about. How do we transmit? And I'm privileged now to have, we have four generations at our Seder table. It's an amazing thing, so special. And I used to be so jealous of other families. You know, in our first Seder, we hosted everybody. We lived in a retirement building when we first got married. It was all Jews, all in their 80s, and us in our 20s. But even at 22, I was into Kiruv, so I invited everybody on the floor to our Seder. And it was just us. I was making my own Seder, and I invited the entire floor, 14 apartments, of old Jews. And they all came. So I made the Seder, and I loved having it and having all these old people around the table, and we all told stories, and they were all American-born old Jews, who would all be 100 now. So they didn't have accents. It was interesting to think about them. But I wished that it was our family that we had around the table. And now we do. Now my in-laws come. We're the grandparents. They're the great-grandparents. And our grown kids who are married and their kids together. It's an amazing thing to have a Seder table as full as this or more that's our family. It's a very exciting thing to see what you build. So, but in the middle of that, in the middle of the transmission, is a question mark. We don't know all the answers. We're passing on answers, but we don't know them all. It's not that they're not known. They're known. But we don't know them all, and that doesn't get in the way of us transmitting what we do know. Right? Just because we don't know something doesn't mean that we can't transmit what we have. So transmit what we have and trust that there is still the rest. Just hopefully we'll get it at the right time. So that's an important thing to know. So that's the Eliyahu's cup. Right, when I tried to tell this to my daughter-in-law from Muncie, I said, do you know why it's called the Kos Eliyahu? I started to say, it's not because he comes to drink from it. She put her hands over her ears and she started stamping her feet. She said, you're ruining my childhood! Stop! Stop! So, not everybody could hear this, but you're all mature enough to hear this concept. Eliyahu's not coming to drink from the cup. Okay, now with that in mind, so for halacha, we always have to know how it works, but for hashkafa, Jewish thought or philosophy, we don't have to pick one way. There isn't a right or a wrong. There's several rights, or there could be even conflicting streams of thought that are correct. I don't know how that works exactly, I just know that that's true. So, and the Rambam says, we do not have to pick between them. We can hold different thoughts in our mind, and we don't have to, since we're not going in a certain direction because of it, we can just entertain the different streams of consciousness that there are. So that's what I wanted to give as an introduction here. We're learning about souls. I'm going to give you the prevalent theory on souls in the Jewish world today. It doesn't mean it's the only one, and it doesn't mean there's not conflicting ones. There are some different theories. But this is the main one that most people are holding by today. This is a theory that comes down through Nachmanides, and then from him through the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, as written about in his book Derech Hashem, and continuing so, and I haven't yet learned all of Das Tfunos, that is his next book in the series, but I'm working on that now and deepening some of these ideas. But so I'm just basically sharing with you that which is available in the book The Way of God, Derech Hashem. If you want to hear a lot more details about it, you can go to my website, abiteoftorah.com, which is at the bottom of your page, and I have a whole series on Derech Hashem, 40 classes so far, and it's all free, so you can download them and listen to them. Or burn CDs, even if you want. Depending on your level. I learned how to upload so far, and downloading, still not so good at it. So I like CDs. Okay, so the word for soul is neshama. So, and that's the same word as the word for breath, neshima. Right? So to breathe in and to breathe out is lin shom. Neshima, neshama is that word for breath or soul. And it comes from the verse in Genesis, and I just wrote down the source. I just, again, didn't get it Tanakh, but if you look it up in chapter 2, verse 7, it says, and God blew into the Adam a nishmat chayim, the soul of life. Right? But it's a blew in, it comes from the word breath, so he breathed it in. So we understand that the breath, somehow, just like when we blow up a balloon, our breath is in it. So something of us, it's not actually us, but that was of us, is now in that balloon and gives it shape. So it's sort of like that with the neshama. It's often used, they didn't have balloons when they wrote all these analogies, but they used the analogy of a glass blower, right, that he blew into, like shaping glass. Has anybody ever seen a glass blower at work? Mm-hmm. You have this restoration village over here, right, with Ford. I remember going there once as a girl. Yeah, so it's fascinating to watch. So blowing in, it gives shape. So the question is then, so we have this neshama that comes into us. What is this neshama? So this is what we want to learn about. The Rambam has his whole theory on souls, which is different than I'm not going to share tonight. But one thing I do want to share is that he was a physician, and he understood that understanding souls like understanding bodies helps you work with them better. So if you understand your body and how it works, nutrition, health, blood pressure, etc., you know how to manipulate those things to make you healthier. Same thing with the soul. The more you understand about souls, the more you can work with your soul to make you spiritually healthy. So that's why we're learning about this stuff. So, who knows what the word ensoulment is? It's an English word, an actual English word. It means when the soul goes into the body. Different religions have different views on when ensoulment occurs. So our view is 40 days. Some people feel it's at conception. Some people feel it's at birth. We feel it's at 40 days. The practical implication of that would be different religions' thoughts on abortion, when that might be permitted. If you don't believe that ensoulment occurs until birth, then really it's just a hunk of tissue growing inside somebody, and no soul inside. It's not a human being, right? If you believe ensoulment happens at conception, then from conception it's a human being, and how could you destroy that? Right, so we don't hold on either of those extremes. We're at 40 days, so we have some halachic room.
Which is like first trimester, right?
So it's a little before that. Yeah, it's just 6 weeks, basically. Yeah. So before that, there's a drop of halachic space for abortion. More space there. And after that, much less space. There's always space if a woman's life is in danger. But for preference sake, there's hardly any space. But there's a more space before 40 days than there is after because of this concept of ensoulment, right? That's when it goes from tissue to human, is at 40 days. Okay, so we're created in the image of God, which means that our bodies somehow are shaped according to how God is shaped, but except for God has no shape, that we know for sure. So what can that mean? It's a whole different discussion, so we're not going to go there. You could read Rabbi Akiva Tatz. He discusses all kinds of... You have to pick these things up from lots of different places, actually. But I'm not going to talk about it. So God for sure doesn't have a shape. We're not shaped like God. And yet there's something about our shape that reflects something about God. We'll leave it at that. Let's move to souls. Souls are shaped like God. Something about our essence is godly. So what is that? Right? So first of all, what do we know about God? I'll let you guys answer. What do you know about God?
He's like our parents.
Like our parents? In what way?
He's our parent. He, like, protects us. He guides us. He creates things, just like a parent would do.
Mm-hmm. So create. God is a creator. And like a parent, God is a giver. Right? God bestows.
Protector.
And protector, right? So there are things about us that are like God. We can give in a meaningful way. We can create and also destroy. We can use, God chose to create the world through speech. God could have created the world however he wanted. Like, you know, it could have been like I Dream of Jeannie, you know, like that. Or Bewitched, like that. Or Harry Potter, like that. But the way he chose to do it was through speech. He opened his mouth, whatever that is, he doesn't have one, but he used speech to create the world, and then he gave us speech, and our speech is a capacity to create and to destroy. So we have that aspect. So there are a few aspects that we have that are like God. One of them is our uniqueness. There's nothing like God, and there's nothing like any of us. Each one of us is completely unique, just like God, and yet completely unique. So there's uniqueness. But one important thing that we know for sure about God is that there's only one, right? There's one Hashem. Not just that there's one as opposed to many, but that God is one integral whole. Is God's essence is oneness. So what does that mean? If we're going to be created in the image of God, we have to be created also as one, right? So all other creatures on the planet were created in multiplicities, plants created all at once, animals created in pairs, male and female in pairs, human created as one androgynous being, right? The initial human creature was one male and female creature all mixed in together, created as one in the image of God, and then divided in two. Divided in two because the giving thing wasn't working out so well with wholeness, right? If we're whole creatures, then nobody needs anything because we're all whole, right? Imagine if you would see Bill Gates, right? So what could you give him? Give him $100, it takes him, he'll lose more money reaching his hand out to accept your $100 bill, right, to take it from you, then he's earning an interest by just like, you know, whatever, walking past you to not take it, right? But if he's, so your $100 bill makes no difference to him, right? But let's say he's feeling down and you offer him a smile, right? That's something you can give him. Right? You can only, giving is only meaningful when somebody needs what you're giving. Right, so if we're all whole and the whole planet, let's say, is populated asexually and you have all these whole beings, so how is the giving going to be actualized? There's a whole need for giving. Again, we're not going to go fully there and explore that, but just you could know, we need to be able to give to each other in order to actualize ourselves in our human potential to be like God. So that wasn't working out so well as one, but we needed to be created as one to be like God. So then we got divided in two. So two halves of one means everybody has missing parts, and then we can fill in for each other. So we have this whole population on the planet now where we all have missing parts, and missing parts by design. I think about us sometimes as like Swiss cheese. That's holes by design, right? I'm supposed to have holes. And those holes are all invitations to fill in, whether it's other people filling in for you or you filling in for yourself, but it's all holes that we need to fill in. That's what it's for. So we're divided into two, but then after the Adam creature is put to sleep and the Eve creature, the woman creature, is separated out of him, and now you have two half creatures, what's their job? To get back together and become one, right? The whole point is to be like God, which is one, right? So it says, V'hayu l'basar achad, you shall become one flesh. But in the becoming one, and that's a whole class on marital relations and all that stuff, but just as one sentence for that, when you become one flesh, really, in your marriage, when there's a union of mind, heart, body, soul, all that together, it's v'hayu levaser echad. You are proclaiming oneness in the world. Have you ever heard of b'sirot tovot, b'siros tovos? You should have good things. Mevaser levaser is to proclaim the message. So we are the people of oneness, and we proclaim one in the world. So we're supposed to be one like God, create oneness in our marriages, create oneness, unity in our communities, and create a oneness with our body and soul together, oneness with us and God together. We're all about one, creating one. That's our thing, creating oneness. So anyway, so we started out as one, we're divided in two, come back to one, that's our job. Okay, that being said, right, so all of humanity really shares one soul. So I'm just moving down the list here. You don't have to take notes, but this will hopefully help you remember what I said after. All of humanity shares one soul. So that Adam creature was created with the soul of all humanity. And then all of us share a piece of that soul. So we are all connected to each other as one humanity. And yet, the Jews are different. We're actually a separate spiritual species at this point. And the question is, how did we get there? If we all come from Adam, that Adam creature, and then divided into Eve, and then divided into all human beings, how did we actually become Jews? How did we become different? So we have this moving along of Jewish history. God had a plan. The plan was create creatures that will be in relationship with God, be able to receive God, be able to become containers that are so large that they can receive as much God as they create their containers to receive. Each one of us has that choice. That's what we're here for, to become as large as we can, to receive as much God as possible so that we can live in an eternal relationship with God. It's all about that free will and creating that. So here we are in the world. Everybody's supposed to be created to have a relationship with God, and Adam and Eve blew it. Their first choice, using free will, was to separate themselves from God instead of to unite themselves with God. So it shifted everything. Every choice has an impact, right? Think about if you're trying to lose weight, right? So does one M&M really make a difference?
Yes, it leads to more.
It does. Well, one does. One does. Not a big difference, but it does make a difference, right? So
more in the lack of integrity of the choice than the M&M itself.
Well, no, so I'm saying in losing weight, one M&M, that 4 calories or whatever it is, it does make a difference, a tiny difference. That decision to eat it or to forego it gets you a little closer or a little further from your goal. But a piece of cheesecake, if you're going through the Chicago airport, let's say on your way from a trip to Ottawa back to Denver, and the only kosher thing they have there is Ellie's cheesecake, right?
That was God putting something there for you to eat.
Then either it's God putting there something there for you to eat, or it's a bunch of calories in your way between you and your destination, right? So is it supper, or is it a distraction, right? So the question is, if you eat that, are you further from your goal or closer? You're much further from your goal of losing weight, right? So each thing has its impact based on how big the thing is. So decisions also either have a tiny impact or a big impact depending on the nature of the decision. So when Adam and Eve made that first decision, the impact was huge. That was a rocket-powered decision. Either it would have catapulted all humanity into Mashiach, or since they made the wrong decision, it catapulted all humanity down, it dropped humanity down into what we call Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels, the entire transformation of the whole planet. So basically, Adam and Eve were here, their potential was here, the downside was here, and they chose down. But the potential still existed here. So we went through 2,000 years down here at this lower state with the potential of humankind still up here. And people rode along this way for 2,000 years until Abraham was born. From the year zero, if you count, when Adam got a soul, that's zero. The 6 days before that, we don't count. In our count of 5773, the first 6 days aren't counted. We start counting from when Adam got a soul. That's Friday afternoon. Before that, who knows what happened? Was it 6 days? Some people say yes. Was it 6 epochs? Some people say yes. Who knows? Not our conversation, but from when Adam got a soul, that's when we count our 5773. So if that's zero, 1948... Does that ring a bell? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
1948 is when Abraham was born. How cool is that?
So right? Cool.
So that's when Abraham was born, 2,000 years later. Abraham was not the first monotheist. He was the first monotheist with a mission. Right? He was the first monotheist who saw God so clearly that he knew that we must be making a difference. We have to make a difference in the world because of this belief. So there are other monotheists. Noah was a monotheist, right? He built an ark. It took 120 years to build that ark. Who got on it? His family. Did he bring any neighbors? Any community members? Any news broadcast to say, come onto the ark, we're headed towards it? No.
No Facebook.
Nothing. 120 years, and it was Noah, his wife, his sons, and their wives. That was it. No outreach at all. Not one drop, right? After 120 years of building it on dry land where everybody could see what he was doing, it was just him and his family. So he was a monotheist, but not a monotheist with a mission. Abraham was a monotheist with a mission. He wanted to change the world. So he finally, as he's pasturing his sheep, looks up and says, gosh, look at that potential way up there. That's where we could be as humans. How can we reach that? God, I want to reach that, and I want to help other people reach that. And God said, phew, finally somebody gets what's going on here. There's a program for all humanity, and I need humanity to be engaged in it. And now there's somebody who's going to do it. So that was Abraham. Said, I want to bring all humanity into this. Great. So now we have to figure out how that's going to happen. And God tells him what's going to be. I'm really thrilled that you're in the program, Abraham. And Abraham says, great. And he says, and your children are going to be in it too. And Abraham says, basically, how will my children deserve to be part of this program? I see why I deserve. I found you. I made the decision. I decided to separate from everything around me in order to become in relationship with you. That's why he's called the Ivri, somebody who separates on the other side. Right? That's what Hebrew means, somebody from the other side. So Abraham was the first other sider. Right? So we're from the other side of the whole world opinion. So, but he said, how will my children get that? God said, don't worry, I'm going to arrange a workshop just for them. I'm going to send them into Egypt, and they're going to be oppressed. It's going to be really difficult. They'll be slaves, and then they're going to come out with a lot of stuff. So he's like, how's that going to help? I don't really get it. God says, just trust me on this. It's going to work. So into Egypt we go, where we're squeezed really tight. So Mitzrayim, Egypt in Hebrew, the root of the word is tsar, like tsuris. Right, so when we have tsuris, what are tsuris? It's when things are rough, things are hard, and we're squeezed so tight. So think about one of those old-fashioned washing machines that have those rollers that you wring things out by running it through the rollers. That's what happened when we, as a nation of 70, went into Egypt. We were put through the wringer, squeezed so tight and in so much pain. It hurt so much. But what was happening, the process, it was a spiritual squeezing through the physical channel that caused all the regularness of humanity to be squeezed out of us. So now we're left with some inner core squeezed tight, and then like that, in that squeezed place, whisked out of Egypt and brought to the foot of Mount Sinai. And imagine a sponge that you squeeze tight. How absorbent is it? Really absorbent, right? Then brought to Mount Sinai. And that's where we started to absorb all those empty spaces that where we were squeezed so tight. The light of the Torah started to be absorbed into us. And that's how we can be a light unto the nations. If we're supposed to shine God's light in the world, we have to absorb it from somewhere. So we absorb it from the, we don't pronounce it this way, Torah, right? We pronounce it Torah. But the center of the word is Or, really. So light in the Torah, it could mean teaching, it could mean parent, it could mean law. But there is a sound of light in the center of the world, because that's where we absorb the light of the world. And where we shine the light, it comes from there. Parenthetically, it comes from the sukkah too. Anybody who doesn't know, the sukkah represents the clouds of glory, which is, if you think about us, as glow-in-the-dark people, because that's who we are, right? So any glow-in-the-dark thing has to be recharged by being held up to the light, right? So it can glow in the dark. So our annual recharge is in the sukkah, where we go in and the sukkah walls radiate the light into us. That's why we want to spend as much time as possible in the sukkah, even sleep in there if we can, right? To try to absorb the light that comes shining through the walls into our soul. That's our annual light absorption station. Even if we don't sleep in it, even if somebody else can sleep in it, since we're all Jews connected to each other, it gets absorbed all around, which we'll talk about now. Okay, so now we got squeezed out, and we got and we opened up and received the light. So that's how our soul was shifted from all humanity into Jewish status. So now those people who went through that double process, and you had to go through both, those people became the Jews. Before that, it was all optional. You were the children of Abraham before that, right? But to become the Jewish people, you had to go through the double process of squeezing and absorbing, accepting the Torah. From there, being Jewish was no longer a choice, right? Before that, everybody got to choose in or choose out. From there, you're in. Once you're in, you're in. It's a one-way door, no exit. Kind of like the Hotel California, right? A little hot deal. Okay, so now we have the concept that there are 600,000 Jewish souls who got the Torah. But how many people were there getting the Torah? Does anybody know? Anybody can answer.
3 million.
3 million, right? We say 3 million because there were six. We understand there were 600,000 Jewish men between the ages of 20 and 60. But there were also people under the age of 20, and there were also people older than 60, and their female counterparts. So we count about 3 million. So if there are 600,000 souls and 3 million people, how did that work, right? Were there either soulless people, or did they share souls? So we do have an understanding of sharing souls, of the souls maybe being splintered. So you would first have to take that 600,000 and divide 3 million into it and see how many, like what percentage of a soul each person had. But we understand there's 600,000 souls altogether, Jewish souls. So you really have to take all Jews who ever lived, ever, and will live, take that number and divide it into 600,000. And that's the soul chip that we have. Right? So because there's just that many souls. Really, though, there's one soul. So it's really that we're all different expressions of one whole soul. So there's all kinds. That's why I started with the question mark in the middle of the table, okay? Because there's lots of different theories, and sometimes they can conflict, and sometimes you can bring them together. So we have a concept of one Jewish soul, and we have a concept of 600,000 Jewish souls, and clearly each one of us has a soul. Well, what are those souls? So these are all questions, and they require really different theories to be able to work out. But let's just go with the one soul for a second, and then we'll go back to the 600,000 souls. So the one soul concept is that we are all one. We look like we're separate because we're all separated by skin. We're all in our little packages. But it's sort of like a mum plant. Did you ever plant mums? So as a new bride, when we moved into our house, actually, so I wasn't quite so new, but newly in touch with the earth because we came from an apartment to a house, I figured I'm going to plant flowers all up my walk, right? So I go to the store and I buy like 3 mum plants because they're huge, right? They're like a bush. I figure, no problem, I'll divide it. You know, I just need like a few and I'll divide it and I'll put like, you know, up the walk like
that.
Probably
pretty for a minute, right?
They don't divide. Turns out I brought them home and I go to the bottom and I see there's one stick and 300 blossoms from the one, right? It's not like pansies, let's say, where you can tear the dirt apart, right? It's just one bush with all those blossoms. That's the Jewish people. We're one at our root. But each one of us is an individual blossom. So we all blossom separately, but the truth is we're all united at the root. So different manifestations, but all manifestations of the one. So that's the one soul that we Jewish people are. And that's why somebody else sleeping in the sukkah can enliven your soul as well, or you taking the time to go on a sukkah makes a difference for other people's soul. Everything that we do, positive and negative, does impact on the whole because we're all part of the whole and inseparable from the whole. We just have our own little package that we can walk around in, but we're all connected at the root. So, okay, so we have these 600,000 souls, and we have a concept of reincarnation also. So reincarnation, which again is one of those theories that is generally widely held in the Jewish world today, but not every sage agrees with, but we generally are holding that today. So reincarnation. So let's say you're reincarnated, right? Reincarnated a few times. So first of all, why do we get reincarnated? We're not Buddhists. We don't believe everybody goes again and again and again and again and again.
To perfect our soul. There's something that needs perfecting.
Something that needs perfecting. That's the point of reincarnation, is something. Right, something needs to be worked on. So reincarnation is for those who need it and those who deserve it. You have to have both. Those who need it and those who deserve it. You have to have done enough right that it's worth it to bring you back. But you have to have done not enough right that you need to come back. Right? So you need to be in that combination, because if you completely blew it, no point in bringing you back. You're done. Right? If you completely ace it, no need to bring you back because you're done. Right? So it's only for those people in the middle. That's us, by the way. Apparently, since the Vilna Gaon, everybody born since him is all old souls figuring out stuff. We're all ironing out the last little wrinkles before the end of time. We're coming up towards shifts in the whole universe. Anyways, we're all here. Yes, we are. It's pretty scary to see. We're like 5 to 12 right now. It's pretty exciting. So with all this reincarnation, then you could wonder, we also believe in resurrection, right? So once we're resurrected, meaning our body gets out of the grave, whatever that means, and it doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to see your grandmother walking down the street, although people say that. When you see your grandmother, you know, maybe it's your great-grandmother because your grandmother's still alive. But when you see your great-grandmother walking down the street, you'll know Mashiach is around the corner or has arrived already, right? Is that true? Is she going to get out of the grave like that? I mean, she was pretty sick when she died. So is she going with her walker down the street? Or, according to Chabad, she's 19, right? What does 19 mean? You know, 19 is in the flower of your youth. Think about 19-year-olds. Like, we're all older than 19. I love looking at 19-year-olds. Like, I'm not a guy, but I look at these 19-year-old girls, I'm like, you're so beautiful. You know, they're just so, like, there's something so attractive about them. You know, it's just so much fun to look at them. They're so beautiful. So fresh, right? So that's the idea, is that there's going to be a freshness. Really, what is it? I mean,
I'm a 19-year-old.
Oh. And then she's so beautiful. Other people probably think she's beautiful. Okay, for moms, they could be a little challenging, but other people, 19-year-olds.
She's my least challenging. She's my favorite one. Like a phone call.
Right. But you'll see other people's 19-year-olds are stunningly gorgeous. So I think that's why the Syrians all get married at 17, you know, like there is no shit-up crisis there, like we're all married like that, right? So anyway, so what does that mean? It's sort of resurrection. It's not that your body's getting out, but it is your body. We plant something in the earth. That's why we bury. We bury in a certain way, sort of like burying a tulip bulb. Right? When we put that bulb in the ground, the bulb is not what comes out in the spring. Nobody's surprised when a flower comes out. That's what you planned, right? You put the bulb in. It's just a hunk of brown. That's a brown ball. You put it in, and in the spring, up comes green with red on the top. It's so pretty. It's so different than what you put in, but it is what you put in, right? If you try to dig up the bulb at that point, it's not there, right? It didn't squeeze up through the tube and come into a flower. What is it? So part of planting flowers, part of seeing the dead trees now, they look so empty, and yet they come back to life. It's part of it is teaching us that we have a cycle of death and life, and death and life, but death is not the end. That there is a natural and not miraculous, in a way, rebirth that happens after death every time, right? You plant and you see life. So you plant a body in the ground and it's going to blossom again. But it's not going to be that body that comes up. It's going to be what's genetically related to it. That's the blossom of that body coming up. So there will be something physical that is connected to what we planted. But it's going to be different. And it's going to be, it's interesting to think about, it's going to be different. It's going to be a physical thing that doesn't yet have a shape until the soul's reunited with it. When the soul's dropped back into it, It'll in a way, hard to, you know, who knows exactly, but it's going to, in a way, like, effervesce and switch all around physically to be the physical representation of the soul. That's what we're supposed to be now. But we're held back by divine decree. It's not possible for us to totally reflect our souls right now for many different reasons. That's a whole another long story. But you do see some people's souls do shine through. There are some people that you see that have an extra special shine or an extra special sweetness that you can see, because that is, their soul is shining so strongly that you can feel it in some people. And most people, not so much, but you can a little bit. It's going to be much stronger with the resurrection, and it's going to be that transformation where the soul and the physical recombine, and it's going to be an expression of the spiritual, a physical expression of the spiritual reality.
Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. So, you're saying that part of someone's soul is still on Earth, like the whole. I got a little lost.
Okay.
So someone's going to get resurrected, but they're going to combine with a soul that's still on Earth.
Okay. Didn't get there yet.
Oh.
Okay.
Didn't get lost.
Okay, you didn't get lost. You didn't get lost. I just took it in a direction that, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So you didn't get lost. Okay. So the question is, if we're reincarnated, so I'm setting up the whole resurrection thing, what it looks like, so that we can talk about reincarnation and then ask this question. Once you're reincarnated, who the heck are you? The wife of this husband, or the wife of that husband, or the wife of the husband three gen? Like, right? Whose mom are you? Right? It could be very confusing.
That's right.
Right. So the problem is that we're thinking very literally, and the truth is that our souls are much bigger than who we think we are right now. So who we think we are, in a way, it's sort of, in a way, it's sort of like acting, that one actor can play many different roles, but they retain their sense of self, even though they can manifest in many different ways on stage, right? So in a way, it's like our soul or that soul that we are can manifest in different ways in different lifetimes, but it retains a sense of self and who it is. And it's not about the marriage or the parenting. All those are workshops for the soul's growth in that incarnation. Just hold that as a little piece of thought, because it's confusing and complicated and hard to work with who we are today, but you should know that we're much bigger than what we look like. Okay, let's move past that to family souls. Hopefully I'll leave you with a lot of questions so that you'll just study more. So family souls, there is a concept of family souls. So we still, even though we are not the physical representations of our spiritual reality, there is a level of us that is a physical representation of our spiritual reality. So we see that in family members. Families have souls too. There's something about a whole family that shares a spiritual energy. And that's why we look like each other in our families. We inherit our mother's looks, and some of her attitudes, and some of different things. You know, I saw somebody had a sign on the wall that says, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, I am my mother after all." Right? How does that happen? Like, you're 20 and you're positive, you're never, ever, ever going to be like that. And then you're 40 and like, oh my gosh, look at me. I'm saying the same things, I'm thinking the same things, right? So, and maybe some of them are different or evolved or whatever, but the point is that we care, there is family baggage that we carry, right? You can see it in abused families. It's very hard for somebody who comes from a line of abuse to make a switch and not abuse. Even if they know they don't want to, it may switch form a little, it may go from physical to emotional, right? Or it may go from emotional to financial, but they're still abusing, right? It's hard to get out of the family thing, but it's possible. Right, once you recognize it. So there are different people who are offered opportunities to create a tikkun, to create a reparation for family stuff. Sometimes it's through money and sometimes it's through situations. Whatever it is, there are times that people can shift family energies. But a reason that we look like our families and inherit our families' physical stuff and emotional stuff is because we are carrying that family energy forward. And it's our job to deal with it in this generation. So we get to share in the family soul and how we can work with it. Just keep your antennas up for the Book of Esther. When Mordechai says to Esther, you get to pick what you want to do here. So you can either choose. The Jews are going to be saved. That's not a question. The question is, who do you want to be? Right? Do you want to be a part of saving it? Or do you want to throw away your whole life and your parents' life too? You and your father's household could go down the tubes with your decision. Or you could save everybody. That's up to you. The Jews are going to be saved without you. The question is just you and your family soul. Where is that going to be in the story? That's one of the things to see. You'll see that. That's in the, when you hear it being read, just pay attention to that. You'll hear something about family souls. Okay, so now let's go to our soul. We have two souls. The first soul is called a nefesh, and that's our animal soul. Everybody has that, even plants. And animals and human beings. We all have an animating life force that's called a nefesh. And that's actually technically physical. It's not spiritual. It's the most ethereal of all physical things. And that's what makes us alive, makes animals alive. Everybody has a different shaped nefesh, so to speak. Of course, it doesn't have shape. But that's what makes the difference between a snake and a human being is their nefesh. Or let's just do snake and dog, right? Clearly there's a difference between snakes and dogs, right? Snakes don't slither up and greet you when you walk into the house, right? And then I have little adoring eyes, right? And we had a snake for a little while. We had fish that would swim to the top of the tank when we walked into the room because they knew they were going to get fed. But they didn't, like, stare out of the tank like, I love you, right? But the dogs do, right? The dogs just stare at you all day long. They're just like, I love you. Take me on a walk. I love you. Right? They have a whole different energy. So I try to sit. I have a dog, and he comes over, and he puts his nose under, and he wants me to pet him. Like, and I try to sit like this. He's like, no, pet me, pet me, pet me. Like, I'm trying to bench, you know? I have to stand up sometimes to finish benching. It's like he's all over me. So they have that. So what makes the difference between that, the snake or the fish and the dog is the nefesh. The shape is what gives them their different energy, right? What gives them their ability for fidelity or kindness or how they want to be in a relationship with you. That is their nefesh. And we also have a nefesh that gives us our human-like quality. But what gives us our humanity, really, is our neshama. Right, so neshama, so you're about to look at the middle of your list and think that that's what you're going to circle, but you're not. Circle nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida. The whole thing is called a neshama. Our neshama has five layers. And the bottom layer of our neshama is called nefesh. And so not to be confused with the animal soul, which is called nefesh. It is confusing, but they're two separate things. You will hear these words used in different places. You'll hear the word ruach used for spirit. You'll hear the word neshama used for soul. You'll hear the word nefesh also used for soul and interchangeably. So right now, I'm using it technically the way Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the Ramchal, uses these words. Okay, so nefesh is the animal soul, and then nefesh is also the bottom layer of the neshama. So the neshama is the human soul. Only human beings have a neshama. All human beings have a neshama, Jews and non-Jews. We do not believe that Jews have souls and non-Jews are just animals that like don't have souls. That's not our belief. All human beings are created in the image of God. All human beings have a neshama. All human beings have the capacity, bless you, to actualize their divine spark and create a relationship with the divine through their neshama. So there's these different levels. So nefesh. Nefesh is the bottom level of our human soul, and that's the part that rests up against us, whatever that means, right? That's the part that's sort of like our personality, right? Who we are, the part that like kind of is up against the edge of us, against our flesh. Really, the animal soul, the nefesh, is connected to our blood, and the nefesh of the neshama is connected to that nefesh. And then the rest comes like links in a chain. Imagine a chain with five links. It's one chain, but each link is separate, but they're connected. So that's what our neshama looks like. Five links of one chain. And that's kind of tied together to the nefesh of our animal soul. So we have nefesh. That's our bottom part. We have neshama. That's our middle layer. That's where our spiritual aspirations are. Our desire to go up, to connect, to even blend into the divine. Have you ever had that feeling? Sometimes, I don't know if you feel it, but sometimes you see something that's so stunning, a sunset, the Grand Canyon, and you sort of just want to like become part, like jump into it and just like blend, right? So that's a sense of wanting to become one. I think for anybody who has a dog, sometimes they like bite you a little bit, not biting, but they're like, they want to eat you up, just like we say with babies. I just want to eat you up. You're so cute. What does that mean? Do we want to eat? No, we don't want to eat them, right? We say about little kids, they're so cute. You could just eat them up. When they're teenagers, you wish you had. But it's not that we actually want to eat them up. That's disgusting. What are we saying? We love them so much, we want to blend with them, right? We want to take them into us somehow and become one. So there is that sense. That's the neshama feeling. I want to join in the oneness, right? Just to let go of all the external boundaries of who I am and blend in with this. So the neshama feels that. So we don't usually feel our neshama, but we feel the pull of our neshama on that level. We feel our nefesh, because that's really where we operate, is in that zone. But we feel the pull of our neshama pulling us up. The ruach meaning spirit or wind by its nature is unstable. That blows around. And that's what mediates between the nefesh level and the neshama. That's what helps pull the nefesh up, that you would have these aspirations and brings the aspirations down also. So pulls the feelings of the neshama into the nefesh and pulls the nefesh up towards the neshama. So the ruach does that movement thing, and sometimes can make you feel unstable, right? That when you have feelings of ajna, that could be the nefesh, the ruach, just moving around and stirring you up. So that's that. The upper two levels, chaya and yechida, we don't usually feel. Hardly anybody ever feels into those. Those are really for sublime levels of people. Maybe in the ancient days when they had schools of prophecy, and this is a whole interesting concept of what are prophets and what's the whole thing. It's not about saying the future. That's only one thing that can happen. Prophecy really is about connecting to Hashem so deeply that you channel a divine energy into the Jewish people at its root to nourish all the Jews. So along with that, some words could come in. But we had over a million prophets during the First Temple. So if you think about how many Jews we had during the First Temple period, if you think about all the generations, what do we have, 40 million? So that means that 1 in 40 people was a prophet. That means everybody knew somebody who was a prophet, right? Not everybody is saying prophecies or writing stuff down. We only have a few books, right, that are prophecies for forever. But we had a lot of prophetic energy. It was about channeling that divine energy into the Jewish people. Maybe some of those people, and not all, felt into the Chaya or Yechida level. But most of us don't. However, we do feel the influences. Those are the levels that can separate from us while we're sleeping. So when we have out-of-body experiences, or what feels like it, actually the lower four, even the Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, and Yechida, but mostly what we don't feel, Chaya, and Yechida, those can separate from us as we're sleeping. So imagine sort of like a kite, right? So you hold onto the kite string, and the kite can go high up into the sky. It's still connected to you, though. Even though it's far away, it is still connected. Right? So like that, when we're sleeping, the bonds of connection of these parts of our soul can be loosened and they can go far away. But they can only go as far as the string that you can let out. And then as they're going far into spiritual realms while you're asleep, they can go into different spiritual realms to learn different things or connect in different ways, but they can only gain access with a visa. They need some kind of permission to get into the zone. So the length of the kite string and the visa is granted based on how you behaved the day before you fell asleep. Right? That day, however you behave today, says where your soul parts can go tonight. So that there's different, they can access different realms or not have access to different realms depending on who you are and how you behave. Because it's all about the physical and spiritual blended, right? Once they can float in their certain areas, they can then, as they come back down, channel that information down through Yechida to Chaya to Neshama to Ruach to Nefesh into the animal soul, which is part of your imagination, which can mix it into your dreams.
Can you give an example of like how your behavior could lengthen your string?
Yeah. Let's say you're harsh with somebody. And you say, that's such a stupid idea. Somebody comes and tells you, you know what I want to do? I want to create unity among the Jewish people. And so I'm going to make an all-Detroit picnic of all the Jews. And you say, that's dumb. Nobody's going to come. There are people who eat so kosher, they'll never come to your picnic. And there's people who care so little, they'll never be there. Right? So you just slapped somebody's idea down, which shortened your string. Right? You hurt their feelings, and you took away from their vision of trying to create unity. Right, rather than saying, what a great idea, how could we figure it out that it will, like, right, that would lengthen your string. Right, so depending on what you're doing, depending on what you eat, depending on how you move, depending on how you park, right, did you swipe in and take somebody else's space, right, when they were signaling to go in? Not so much in Detroit, but in New York that happens, right? You have to know how to get a space, right? Did you do that? So, oh, that shortens your string right there, right, or cuts you off from a certain area. Did you sit down and help somebody? Did you greet somebody kindly? Did you give somebody a hug when they needed it? Did you take the extra time to sit with your own child when they needed to tell you something, when you were about to run out the door but you decided to be late to whatever because they needed you? That could gain access to something. Did you not get angry when somebody deserved it, right? But you chose not to. That can open a whole set of doors for you. So it can really make a difference, all the things that you choose to do. We don't always feel like we're in choice, but the more we learn, the more we can see we're in choice about how we behave, how we think and feel. All of that changes where our soul can go and what it can accomplish. Does that answer that? Okay. Okay, so we are sort of like dead when our soul leaves. Sort of like. We have this concept of 1/60th. 1/60th is that fraction that has existence, you can tell, but you can't taste, right? That's why it's a measure in keeping kosher, right? If you get less than 1/60th of something not kosher, or meat in milk, or milk in meat, it's still kosher, right? Because you can't, it is a real thing that you could see 1/60th, right? If you have 60 chocolate chips lined up, you can see one. That's a real piece. But if you have that volume of cholent and you drop one milchik chocolate chip into it, it doesn't trafe up the whole thing because it's less than 1/60th of milk in your meat, right? Only if it's by mistake, not on purpose. You can't do it on purpose. If it's a mistake.
Alright, guys, find right. A chocolate chip.
If it's a mistake. Right. So we have this concept, so that number is used for other things too, like for instance, one 1/60th of somebody's illness is taken away when you visit them. And your 1/60, sleep is like 1/60th of death. Because there is a slight loosening of the bounds. It's for this reason, when we wake up in the morning, we say, thank you, God, for returning my soul to me. Right? If the whole soul was gone, you'd be dead. That's what death is, when the whole soul is gone. So the whole soul wasn't gone, but part of it was. Thank you for bringing it back, right? But that means you were a little bit dead while you were sleeping. That's why we're very careful to wash our hands in the morning when we wake up. There's a ritual washing that's the same as the washing as when we exit a cemetery, because it's a washing that pertains to death. So there was some level of spiritual disconnect in our bodies because part of us was disconnected, right, or loosened. And there is a rule, Hashem just made a rule, that all of that spiritual disconnect that's all over our body while we're sleeping all concentrates in our fingertips once we wake up. And so we wash our hands over our fingertips to wash it away. And that water, unlike, let's say, washing for bread, let's say you live in the old days, you have to haul water from a well, right? You're washing for bread. It's a lot of water to haul, and all that washing. You can use your bread washing water to water your plants, but not your Negelwasser water, not your morning water. That water is so toxic because it does have a death energy in it that you can't use it for your animals or for your plants. That water gets thrown away. So today it's easy. It just goes down the drain. We don't even think about it. But just so you know, there is a difference between water that comes off your hands for washing for bread and water that comes off your hands for washing in the morning. There's a big difference in those waters. So that there is a reason to wash in the morning that comes from the soul being loosened and then coming back into the body. Okay. How much time do I have? Not much. I have to finish up, right? Yeah, okay. Okay, let's talk about how the soul comes into the body. So the soul comes in at 40 days. That's when it first starts coming in. But it turns out there's a long process of coming in that actually takes years for the soul to finally come into the body. So the first chunk comes in at 40 days. The next chunk comes in at birth. After that, I want to introduce a whole topic, but we unfortunately did lose a granddaughter this fall. She was under 30 days old. So under 30 days, it turns out, there's different burial rules because their soul isn't fully in their body yet. So they don't need the same kind of tikkun that's necessary for somebody whose soul has been in their body and they've been in the world for longer. So the soul doesn't fully come in, well, even at 30 days. After 30 days, though, after birth, there is another chunk that comes in. So after that, you would need to sit Shiva or whatever for somebody who dies after 30 days. But it's still not fully in the body. So there's another point that, and here's a question mark, at 3. 3 is considered the age of education, so a little more shifts in at that point. It's time to start educating. And then for sure at age 12 or 13, for a male or for a female, so bar or bat mitzvah, but the soul isn't fully in place, and any mothers of teens know this, until age 20, right?
So even
there
then.
Is, right. So there is a grace period, actually, between bar mitzvah and 20 years old. So that while a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah is held accountable for all rules, period, they're not fully punishable for rules between them and God until they're 20. Between them and man, they are. So if they steal, they're held as an adult for stealing. But if they sleep through shacharis, or if they, I don't know about Yom Kippur, so I don't want to say that. But if they make a mistake in something else between them and God, they're not held fully accountable until they're 20. So there is. That's when the soul finally comes in. Now let's talk about how the soul leaves. Right, the soul also leaves in pieces over time. It disassociates. So the definition of death for us here is when the soul leaves the body. Right, that's when somebody's dead. But the soul actually takes some time to leave. So you can see, for somebody who dies over time, not somebody who got hit by a bus, right? So then their soul leaves right then, right? But for somebody who's sick and dying, anybody who's been with somebody who's like that, you can see their soul loosening before they actually die, right? In the weeks or days before their death. It starts to loosen. You can see it in their face. You can see it in their skin color. You can see it in their responses. It loosens before. Then when they die, the soul leaves, but it's not gone. It's hovering around their physical body. When we do a tahara, when we do the washing, the ritual washing and dressing of the body before we bury it, we actually apologize to the soul for infringing on the body's privacy, right? You keep the body covered like you do in a massage, you know, just uncover one leg at a time and cover it back up and uncover the, wash the whole thing. And then, but then you do have to, in order to either put them in the mikvah or pour over, there's nine kabim, whatever, nine measures of water that you can pour over the top. When you do that, you have to uncover the whole body all at once. So the body is there naked. So it is embarrassed in front of you, right? So when you finish the whole thing, after you've dressed the body, you apologize to the soul for infringing on the privacy. So the soul is right there, experiencing the shame, actually, of the body being undressed in front of strangers, right? Who wants that? So, so the soul is right there. Then the next step of separation is when the body is buried. So you do want to bury. We try to bury quickly and with honor and respect because that helps the disassociation of body and soul and helps separate from that level of pain that's associated with the body being uncomfortably treated. So we are careful to bury as quickly as possible. The only time that we delay a burial is if somebody that person would really want to be at their funeral can't make it, so we might wait for that person. But otherwise, we try to bury as quickly as possible. It helps the soul disassociate from the body. Then the next step is the end of Shiva. So during Shiva, the soul is still in the home, in the Shiva home. And that's one reason why we're supposed to sit Shiva in the home of the deceased, if possible. Because they are connected to their home. It's part of their, in a way, part of their garments is their home. Their body, their identity, their family, and their home is part of what that soul wore in this world. So you want to, if you can, sit Shiva in the home of the deceased. And even if there's only one person sitting Shiva, you still say the comforting sentence that we say in the plural. In Hebrew, it's in the plural because we're comforting not just the person who's left behind, but the soul who's leaving is also sad at the departure. So we comfort that soul too. So we know that that soul is there. And interesting, just to think about, if let's say there's different Shiva houses, right? Somebody lives in Israel and somebody lives in America, and they're both sitting Shiva for their parent who died in New York, right? So one's in Detroit, and one sibling's in New York, and one's like, everybody went to go for the burial, and then they separate back home and sit in their different places. Still, there's some aspect of the soul that's there. It's not because it's not one hunk of a soul. There are aspects that can separate out. So it's still there. So, okay, so then the soul is still somehow associated with the body and still there. It separates out even further at 30 days. And then a final but not complete separation is at 1 year. So those are the halachic stages of mourning, and the soul disassociates more at each one. And we see from different stories that we've all heard that there are encounters with the deceased. Somebody told me a fascinating story yesterday that her grandmother died. And before about a year was over, her grandmother died and her eldest was not talking yet. And then her eldest started talking. He was not quite two. And he said, "Who's that behind you?" to his mother. And she turned around and didn't see anything. She saw a portrait of her, and her husband was sitting across from her. And she said, "Oh, that's Mommy and Daddy in the picture." And he said, "No." And he referred to her grandmother by first name. Not by grandma, but by whatever she had a Romanian name that was weird. It wasn't even a name that anybody uses. You know, it's Onesie or whatever her name was, right? He wasn't talking when she died, right? He recognized her. She was there. And he called her by name. That, and her husband was there. She was really glad her husband was there because like she didn't think she really experienced that. Like he saw her. So we do. There are experiences that people have of that person coming back. More often, those experiences are in the first year, and they become less and less and less over time, less frequent and less clear. As the soul disassociates from its physical expression, it becomes less and less clear, and you don't see it as well. So there is further disassociation. That being said, there still is some association with the physicality, so that if you go to one's grave, you can still access. It's like cell phone bars, right? The greatest reception is at the person's grave. That's where you can connect the most to that soul. There's higher reception there. And even souls that have departed a long time ago, that's why we go to the graves of great ones, to try to access assistance in learning their Torah, for instance. I love learning the words of the Ramchal. I hope that I'll get to go to Tzfat and visit his grave one day and say, you know, I appreciate your teaching. Thanks for writing down what you did. Please help me continue to learn what you've written. You know, like, just like, whatever. I want to learn your stuff. So, and even we have an understanding that we are now learning some of the words of the Ramchal. Whatever this means, that's what you say before you say something that's weird, right? Whatever this means, we know that, we've learned that the lips of the person who taught that Torah move in the grave when you teach their Torah. Okay, whatever that means. Doesn't mean that their lips are actually moving, probably not, but it means that you've activated, by teaching their Torah, you've activated something about them. That they are still engaged in the world and their Torah is being spread through you. So there's a connection between the Ramchal and me and you right now as we're sharing his thoughts. And when you share something of the Ramchal to your friends when you go home today and say, I learned something, so you activate that too. So there's ripple effects that everybody creates in their life that go out for good and for bad. Let's say somebody's a pickpocket. Right? And they teach their kids to pick pockets. And they teach their kids. And they teach their kids, right? So every person that's stolen from, the negativity accrues back to the initial one who hammered down the technique on how to pick pockets, right? How to do the distraction thing. Make the person trip and reach into their pocket while they're regaining their, like, that all accrues back to that one person. All those negative ripples go back to him and everybody else that taught them. Or, let's say you're super careful in a certain mitzvah, and you've taught it, and so people, you always greet your children with a smile when they come home from school. Your mother always did that, and you're super careful to always make sure you check the mirror, you look nice, you take a deep breath, you know your kids are coming home, and you are ready with a smile. You know, you're really careful about that, right? So your kids pass that on, and they pass that on, and they pass that on. All those smiles accrue back to you, right? You get all those smiles, or whoever taught you gets all those smiles. So our ripples keep going and going and going. So even though we're gone. That's one reason why Yom Kippur is also called Yom HaKippurim, in plural. Because it's a day that creates atonement for us, for the living, and for the dead. Right? So you could say, why the dead? What'd they do? They've been dead for the whole last year. Right? Like, I see what I did. I blew it many times over the past year. I need kapara. I need atonement. But the dead were in the same place the whole year. They didn't really move. And yet they did. Because people continued to act in what they taught, for good and for bad. So they might need an atonement, depending on the person, but they might. So we can do things that will help atone for them. Let's say we, who learned how to pickpocket from our great-grandfather, right, decide that we're going to become honest. We're going to transform that. We're now going to use that to... We have a certain finger skill. We're going to use it to do illusions to entertain children, to make them happy. And now we take that finger skill and we go to hospitals where kids are sick and we do magic tricks, illusions, right, to enliven people. So we can transform that energy. I don't know if it can necessarily accrue back to that person, but we could say, I'm taking the energy of my great-grandfather and transforming it into something positive. I want to break the chain and I would like it to accrue back to him. So I did get at least some finger savvy from him. I want to use that for good, right? So ask your rabbi about how that works. anyway, okay, so that's about the exit. So let's just go quickly. So the whole point of being here then is to take our souls and transform them. Because if we are a soul before we're born, and we will be a soul after we shed our body, after we die, so we have to ask, what's the point of being here in the physical world altogether? The whole point is to transform our souls. Our souls can't go anywhere without a physical body to take it somewhere. It can just be static, right? So, but with a physical body, it can interact in the world and become something else, negative or positive. We have free will, right? One of my favorite quotes from the Bostoner Rebbe is that the greatest gift God gave to mankind is free will. And unfortunately, he gave it to our children as well. So we all have free will. We can all choose who we want to be, and we all make different choices at different times. Who do we want to become? How do we want to handle this situation? But the point is, it's our choices that make us into who we are. How we come into the world is really how God made us, and how we exit the world is really how we made ourselves. So there's a nice expression that who we are is God's gift to us, and what we become is our gift to God. So we want to create that transformation. That's why we're here. And how do we do it? Through the tools that we have. Our body, our friends, our community, our parents, our generation, our country. Right? It's, we can make a very different spiritual transformation here than we could if we were born in Saudi Arabia. Right? It's a different set of tools being born in America than it is being born, even being born in Canada. It's a different set of tools. So our nation, our generation, our century, our friends, our parents, our bodies and how they work and how they don't, all of that is our toolbox for creating soul transformation. Everything is to be used to transform our souls. So that really, a lot of people see, a lot of religions recognize spiritual and physical, and many see them as a spectrum, that the closer you get to one, the further you get to the other. Judaism can sometimes see it that way, but also sees it this way, really, that the physical is the gateway to the spiritual. That if you want to achieve spiritual goals, you have to go through a physical process. So here we are, spiritual beings, having a physical experience. Right? We're living in this physical body, in this physical world, trying to transform our souls. That's what it's all about. How can we use this physical world to transform our souls? So that's what the whole mitzvah system is about, really. A mitzvah is a physical pathway to a spiritual goal. And it's divided into do's and don'ts. It's really, do's are grow your soul this way. And don'ts are be careful not to diminish your soul this way. That's the whole system, really, in a nutshell. How to grow your soul. There's physical pathways to accomplish it. So I already went way over. There's other information on the other tape, but so you could listen to both if you want. But the point is, ready, set, grow. You're here to grow your soul. Right? That's the whole point of this world, is how can you grow your soul through this? So I'll just give us all a bracha that we should be able to take our physical world, our physical selves, all of our situations, and use them as vehicles to grow our souls. Okay. And anybody can ask any questions, but I know people have to go. So whoever wants to go can go, and whoever wants to ask questions, I'll stay here until your questions are answered.
My poor daughter who like failed a math quiz and she texted me a picture of it and said, tutor, please.
Right.
Her soul needs some help with that.
Yeah. Right.
That's so, here to grow you.
My niece said to me this Sunday, I want to take French.